This is Writer's Voice. We talk to writers of all genres about matters that move us and make us think. Welcome to the show. I'm Francesca Rhiannon.
As you open your focus, you go through life and things don't overwhelm you. They don't produce anxiety as often or as much.
That's biofeedback pioneer Les Femme. We'll talk to him about the open focus brain today. And also, we talk with psychologist Bruce Levine about surviving America's depression epidemic. That's all coming up. Stay with us. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Later in the show, we'll talk about depression in America and how to overcome it. But first, we focus on the brain and how we can train it to improve how we live. How can we deal gracefully with the overload of information and obligations clamoring for our attention, shredding our focus, and stressing us out? With less and less time for thought and reflection, how can we get more focus so that our relationships, our jobs, and our studies are more mindful? Some of us meditate, but if you're anything like me, meditation seems to take too much time and therefore would just stress me out more. But biofeedback pioneer Les Femme says you can practice simple techniques to improve your focus and calm your stress, and they don't have to take a lot of time. Even just a few mindful minutes practiced every day or throughout the day, Femme says, can bring huge benefits. His system is called Open Focus, and he explains it all in his book and CD set, The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. Les Femme, welcome to Writer's Voice. You were one of the pioneers in the field of biofeedback. What got you interested in brainwaves and biofeedback?
Well, I had this idea that we should be able to change the way we pay attention and change the way we behave and link those two to brainwave activity. Here I am 40 years later, still quite interested in this, and I have been using what we call open focus training, paying attention in different ways. We usually pay attention in a narrow focus objective way, and that leads to a lot of stress. In fact, it's called emergency mode attention. It leads to a lot of stress and the accumulation of stress. And if you learn to pay attention in other ways, then one is allowed to release stress and let stress dissipate, dissolve. So you could be in a stressful environment, and if you were stuck in narrow objective attention, stress would accumulate.
Well, let's go right to the meat of it then. You've already entered into it. Your book is The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. You talk about four different kinds of attention. Tell us what they are.
Sure. The first one, the one that we're mostly engaged in, is what we might call paying attention, where we narrow our focus of attention and look at a rather limited part of the environment. We don't attend to anything outside this rather narrow column of attention. And so we call that narrow attention. And it usually is associated with another kind of attention we call objective attention, where we're separate from what we're looking at and we're making an object of it. And, for example, you may be separate from what I'm saying and listening and objectifying and trying to understand would be, you know, part of the process of accepting.
So less emotional stance.
It's less emotional, yes. It's objective. It's the kind of attention that scientists love, you know, objective attention. They want to very carefully and precisely objectify phenomena.
But don't they say that people remember better when they have an emotional connection? For example, well, in either for ill, like in trauma, or for good, like in love?
Yeah, well, it could work that way. It could work oppositely, too. You want to block it, and you can't remember it. So even very good things might be might be blocked, not necessarily intentionally, but for example, if you're in narrow focus and you're attending to, say, something you're reading, everything else is blocked. So we have this mechanism for blocking experience right there, ready for us, all well learned, taught to us by our teachers and our friends and our parents and just about everyone. Everybody wants us to pay attention to them.
Well, you know, this is actually a problem I struggle with a lot. I'm one of those people who has ADD, and, you know, it's called attention deficit, but it's really, to me, I think of it as dysregulation, because just what you say, I can be reading a book and somebody can come right up to me and call my name, and it's only like about the fourth or fifth time they say my name that it penetrates. So what, talk about this open, now I guess you've talked about two different kinds of narrow attention. What are the other kinds of attention that one can use?
There are two others that I deal with. I'm sure there are others, but these are the major forms of attention as I understand what we're doing here. And the third one would be a kind of opening of attention. Like right now, while you're listening to me, you might include being aware of many objects in the periphery of your attention, maybe other senses, not only vision, and you may become aware of seeing space and hearing silence while you're listening to what I'm saying. So the third kind is a kind of opening of attention, a diffusing, so that you become wider in attentional scope. The fourth kind has to do with what might be looked at as the opposite of objective attention, and that is immersed attention. One is so immersed, and I think you were alluding to this before, you're so immersed you don't hear anything. In fact, you can disappear as a person to your own awareness. This isn't uncommon. We do this every day. We disappear and reappear. For example, if you're into sports at all, you may have noticed that some days when you're out there doing apparently very well, you're disappearing a lot of the time. If you talk to people in the realm of sports, the best of them can come off a court and say, "How did I do?" and not be that aware. Musicians say this all the time, performing artists. They become the experience.
Now, I want to go back to the open focus, because even just as you were saying to me, you know, as you're listening to me, you know, you might turn your attention to what you see in your peripheral vision, etc. I found myself relaxing immediately.
Very good. That's generally what happens. And some people are not aware that they relax because they're not tuned into that aspect of their physiology. But that's exactly what happens. So imagine that if you were paying attention in two of these ways. One is a narrow focus, which you're directing various places, like, say, visually looking at the screen or looking at your body or whatever. And around that, there's a much bigger, more diffused awareness. So while you're centered in a narrow focus way on something, you can also see the space all around you, feel it, hear the silence, and experience space in your other senses as well.
But might that not diffuse our attention? Can we still pick up what we need to?
Actually, it doesn't. It allows us to function in a more focused way more, because it doesn't accumulate effort and tension and stress. Unfortunately, narrow objective attention, when overdone, which is my thesis that we all overdo it, as we overdo it, we accumulate stress and tension and come down with all the symptoms that modern-day man suffers.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking to Les Femi about how to focus so as to deal more gracefully with all the aspects of our lives. His book is The Open Focus Brain. Well, talk a little bit more about this connection between stress and the narrow focus.
Narrow objective attention is like the attention paid by the lion on a hunt, stalking his victim and following every motion. And you might notice that the lion is tensed up somewhat and very focused and holding that until his own physiology reaches a point where he leaps into the chase. And this is all brought about and orchestrated by the way he's paying attention. Attention is the organizing function of our activity. So without, you know, the ability to change the way we pay attention, we can't say we wanted to and couldn't get into narrow objective attention. Well, then we would lose out on our ability to be in emergency mode and catch the prey if we were a lion. So this is a valuable thing to be able to jump into narrow focus objective attention, which is what I call emergency mode. And then after the chase, after the hunt, successful or not, to open the focus again and merge with experience and rest, recuperate, let stress diffuse so that one is optimally ready for the next occasion to apply narrow objective attention.
You make a link with anxiety. You've just said here, actually you have a pretty interesting theory about ADD that I haven't heard before. You say that it's connected to anxiety. In other words, it has a more psychological than a brain-based cause. Am I reading you right? And by the way, for our listeners, we are talking with Les Femi. He's the author of The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body, and he's a pioneer in biofeedback and neurofeedback.
So the question is, how do I tie in anxiety? Well, if you were in a clinical setting, as I have been for 40 years, if you had an opportunity during the first session to interview people closely as to, you know, how their life progresses and what they feel and what the problems are, you might, like I do, connect anxiety with many, many dysfunctional behaviors and feelings. This is the simple story, and that is that the more we pay attention in narrow focus, the more anxious and stressed we become. And what we want to do is dissolve the stress. By the way, I'm ADHD also, and that's why attention has always been an important thing in my research career and my interests. So if we reduce attention anxiety, then lots of abilities return to us. It's easier to open our focus. It's easier to merge with our experience. It's easier to pay attention in a narrow, objective way also, just by reducing anxiety. So the main goal for initial training is to reduce anxiety, to help a person learn to produce the brainwave activity associated with reduced anxiety.
We're based here at a university campus. Talk about attention and learning. I think this kind of follows on what you just said, but I wonder if you have an explanation for a phenomenon that I observed when I was in college. I love to read. That's why I do this show. And I have no problem staying awake while I'm reading now. But when I was in school, no matter how interested I was, I always fell asleep over my assigned reading. Is there some kind of an attentional issue going on here?
Well, certainly it is. I mean, what kind of attention did you bring to this assigned reading, and how was it different from the kind of attention you brought to desired reading?
You know, even if I wanted to read it, I think there was that kind of issue. There was a certain anxiety, and there was that sense that I have to do this.
And I have to do it well, and then the feeling that you have to tighten up and become tense and try hard, and that's very tiring. And it's a mechanism itself. Dropping out is a mechanism of managing your awareness.
Wow. Well, that's very useful kind of insight on that. With your book, The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body, you have a CD that has exercises on it, and you also have the same exercises in the book. Could you give us an example, maybe just a brief example, of how somebody could use this method? Give us an example of an exercise, maybe a simple, brief
right.
one.
Right. One of my cautions to my clients is that they not operate a vehicle while listening to the tapes. And the reason is that attention can change quite rapidly and dramatically, and we don't want them behind the wheel struggling, you know, trying to pay attention to driving and then have some release phenomenon of significant degree that it would make driving difficult. So I hesitate to actually give you an example over the air, because some of your listeners obviously will be driving. But I can tell you about the exercise and the idea behind the exercise. In general, the idea behind the exercise is to create a larger sphere of awareness than we usually do. And when you develop a larger awareness, a larger scope of awareness, you widen out visual perception, for example, so that you could see peripherally quite a bit, and you attend to space as well, so you see space and you see objects peripherally and centrally. When you do that, anything that happens, say something in your narrow focus, it becomes small stuff. It's a small percentage of the total of your experience. And that's its value. As you open your focus, you go through life and things don't overwhelm you. They don't produce anxiety as often or as much. And the idea is to gradually merge with a more dispassionate kind of awareness, which is possible simply by broadening your attention to include as many senses as are available to you.
How is this different from meditation?
Well, meditation has so many meanings and involves so many different practices that I avoid it. It's too hard to bring meditation in without knowing the kind and type of meditation that we're talking about. So this has similar effects. I think it's faster. That is, open focus training is faster. And one realizes more directly some of the benefits of practice. And I believe that many forms of meditation are also attention training, but they're different. We do. We emphasize the experience of space. And I'm not personally aware in detail of others who do that, like yogis and such. But recently someone told me that he was in India, and there was a yogi who was using space. And it makes sense to me. I mean, being aware of space is releasing, is letting go. Space goes everywhere, through everything, and extends limitlessly in every direction. So that kind of opening is a very effective release.
And when you say space, you're not just talking about, say, the space beyond us, but also at a real micro level, too. Kind of the space inside your nose, between your eyes.
Yes, the feeling of space, as well as seeing it and hearing it, hearing silence and experiencing the internal dialogue in your mind and the space in which it occurs and mind space. visual space. The images that occur in your mind occur in a kind of visual space also. So we're talking about feeling, hearing, seeing, tasting, smelling, thinking, and a sense of time or timelessness.
We're talking about attention and how to harness it in order to heal mind and body. Our guest is Les Femi. He's a pioneer in the field of biofeedback and the author of The Open Focus Brain. Now, you mentioned, here's another phrase you mentioned, that is phase synchronous alpha. I mean, we know there are different brain waves. There's beta, alpha, theta, and delta. Without going into each one of them, talk a little bit about this phase synchronous alpha. It's a little bit different, and that's kind of that's the goal here in your method.
Yes, that's one of the goals, and a very, very important one in this method. Phase synchrony means a kind of harmony is occurring with the waves measured at different points on the scalp and in the brain. So phase synchrony means when all the waves at all the locations being monitored are in phase with each other, are going up at the same time and then going down at the same time. They're in harmony with each other, in synchrony. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it almost reminds me of kind of parallel processing in a computer. You know, the more, and I don't even know how that works, but I guess the more electrons that can be harnessed at any one time, the more computing can be done.
There may be some similarities.
Now, something else that you write in your book that I found quite interesting is that you work with people with autism. And now we know that autism is, unfortunately, you know, the number of people who with autism seems to be rising quite a bit. People talk about an autism epidemic. Tell us about the work that you've done using the open focus method.
There's an element of autism that suggests that the person is not immersing themselves in the situation. They don't even immerse themselves in the feeling of presence of their own body. And one of the things we do is we monitor preferentially the brain waves in the parietal lobe, which are associated with feeling, body, feeling particularly. And in doing that, we increase the contact that people showing symptoms of autism have. So that's one of the things, that is we emphasize this parietal lobe activity. But in addition, we emphasize synchrony of the parietal lobes. And in that, apparently, is what happens to these people. When we give them feedback as to when they're in phase with each other, they learn a kind of intimacy, a kind of union with their body and with others around them. One mother said that her son, who was autistic, demonstrated an unusual ability to feel and to experience intimately his brother and his sister. He actually played with them for the first time. He kissed his sister on the cheek. And it was just a remarkable demonstration of how powerful it can be for some people. I wouldn't suggest to anyone that it works extremely well for every autistic patient.
And you've also, have you or others have worked with Down syndrome folks with this? Now that I found quite phenomenal. You said you've been able to raise IQ by, you know, quite measurably.
Yes, that's the work of Jerry Fee. She was able to increase IQs rather dramatically.
How could that work? Down syndrome, it's a congenital disorder. It has to do with different configuration of the genes. Why do you imagine that this kind of therapy can actually work, can actually change IQ?
I could speculate that the way you pay attention has a dramatic impact on your IQ. So if you're stuck in one form of attention, let's say stuck in narrow objective attention, you don't have an intimacy with yourself, with material you could learn. So I'm suggesting that attentional flexibility is the general solution to a lot of problems, a whole lot of problems.
And I have to say, I've been using some of these techniques, and I also noticed a difference. We've been talking with Les Femi. He is the author of The Open Focus Brain, Harnessing the Power of Attention to Heal Mind and Body. And I want to thank you, Les Femi, for coming on to Writer's Voice. I think this is a wonderful tool for everybody, but also for students here on the campus of University of Massachusetts.
Well, thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to share my work with you.
And that was Les Femi. You can go to writersvoice.net for links to Femi's website, where you can find out more about his open focus techniques. Next up, we talk to Bruce Levine about surviving America's depression epidemic. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. The history of psychiatry is one of nearly unmitigated failure. That's what our next guest, psychologist Bruce Levine, says. He believes the rush to treat social problems by medicating patients is blinding us to the sickness in our institutionalized society, one that simply doesn't meet human needs. It worships consumption, conformity, and efficiency, but neglects community, autonomy, and diversity. Bruce Levine addresses these and other issues in his book, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy. Levine is a clinical psychologist in private practice since 1985. His previous book is Common Sense Rebellion, Taking Back Your Life from Drugs, Shrinks, Corporations, and a World Gone Crazy. Bruce Levine, I have to say this book was like a breath of fresh air for me. I said, finally, a book that puts depression within the larger social context. What spurred you to write this book?
Well, one of the reasons was exactly what you're talking about, that I felt sort of increasingly embarrassed by my profession, mental health profession, psychologists, psychiatrists, who just were not, and also social workers and counselors, who were not really addressing in any loud way. Maybe they were paying some lip service to what was going on in our society, but not really emphasizing it. And it seemed to me that if the rates of depression were going through the roof, which they are, the rate of depression in the U.S. right now is at least 10 times higher. That's the rate we're talking about, 10 times higher than 50 years ago, that it seemed like the obvious place to look was what was going on in our culture and our society. And so that was one of the motivations why I wrote the book, to kind of talk about that, but also, too, for have people to understand exactly what is depression, as opposed to what they're hearing on these commercials and even what doctors are hearing from drug representatives, which is where they get a lot of their information, maybe most of their information. And also probably most of the book is about what you do, what does people do on an individual level, and what can be done on a societal level, and how those things interconnect. So those are some of my motivations for writing the book, to get all that out there.
Now, you talk about an epidemic of depression, above all among young people. 15 to 17?
Yeah, I mean, one of the really sad facts, there's a lot of depressing facts about depression, and one of the depressing facts is that about a generation ago, about 30 years ago, the average age of first onset of depression was somewhere around 30 years of age. And today, the average age for the first onset is somewhere between 14 and 15 years of age. And I think there's a lot of reasons for that, why young people are feeling more and more depressed out there. And that was one thing that I work a lot with young people. I work with all ages in my practice, but over the years, I've worked with a lot, especially teenagers. And it is depressing how you know, again, 50 years ago, if you took a look at polls, people who were younger were much happier than people who were older, and that's not the case anymore.
And why do you think that's so?
I think there, you know, I think there's a lot of reasons. I mean, I think you're one of the reasons for young people is this increasing kind of disconnectedness. I think they have, just like everybody else in society, there's more isolation, and I think social support is usually an important antidote to depression. I think there's other things too. I think there's many more kind of pressures, and if we have time, we can get into exactly what depression is, which is it's really a reaction to overwhelming pain. And sometimes, you know, this parents believe that, well, if you give kids more and more material things, you know, that's going to turn the trick. But for a lot of kids out there, they have actually more pain than ever in the fact that there's more requirements for them to fit in. So one thing that I talk about a lot in my writings is that if you took a look 50 years ago, 100 years ago in our society, there would be many kids who would be not academic kids, very smart kids, very intelligent kids. But you know they had the kind of intelligence that was meant that they were going to be the kid in the family that was going to run the family farm, and that kind of thing. Well, there's no family farmers almost anymore in America. There's very tiny percentage of the population. So all of those kids who would have been doing that, where do they go? What do they turn to? And so they're in high school or they're in junior high school and they're hating academic life. They know they're smart, but they know they're not achieving anything there. They don't want to be on the school basketball team. They're not cheerleaders. And they feel this enormous pain of alienation. And also what compounds it is their parents feel that pressure that my kid is not succeeding, so he's not fitting in, and the schools are telling me, well, maybe he has some kind of mental illness, he's just not paying attention because he has ADD, attention deficit disorder, or maybe he has some bipolar or some other kind of depression, some other kind of, quotes, mental illness. And at some level, these kids know, I don't think there's anything really wrong with me. I think I'm in the wrong environment. Mostly, they can't articulate this, but some can. Some can really articulate it, and so there's this extra pain that they're having over just living, whereas if they were living in another kind of environment, certainly a pre-industrial kind of society, but even in a family farm world, they would feel like, hey, who I am is fitting in, it's working, and they don't have that kind of pain about their life.
In fact, you just mentioned industrial environment. You talk about the standardization of personality, and it kind of reminds me of, the assembly line. Are we really trying to stamp out people on an assembly line? Talk about why does our society demand a standardization of personality, even now in this time when, it seems that there's so much shakeup. There's so much shakeup in the family, in the workplace. People are moving from job to job.
Well, I think one of the things that's really sort of, again, there's a lot of neat things about modernity. I mean, you have air conditioning, you have refrigeration. So I don't want to just be somebody who's sounding like I'm trashing everything about modern life. But with everything, there's always a downside. And when you have a more kind of industrial society requires more and more standardization. It wants more efficiency, wants more productivity, whether that's on the actual machinery of an assembly line or among people themselves. And one of the arguments that I'm convinced of, not just from my readings, but also from my clinical practice, is that overall in our society, I notice that there's kind of an increased tolerance. From when I was, from 20, 30 years ago, there's an increased tolerance for, race and religion and sexual preference and many things like that, but a dramatically decreased tolerance for differences in personality. And I think part of that is a society, and people started noting this, I should say, in the 50s. One of the famous books on this was, about the organization manned by White. And he started to notice that, our society is definitely requiring more and more of a kind of conformist type of person. And if you take a look at classroom life, a lot of these kids who really are being diagnosed with all kinds of mental illnesses are a lot of, when you really get into them and you really get to know them, which unfortunately a lot of mental health professionals, especially psychiatrists, just spending a few minutes with them, checking their symptoms and maybe giving them a prescription. But if you really start talking with them, you see that a lot of what they're all about is a kind of rebellion, sometimes it's an act of rebellion. They're rarely doing things that are clearly overly rebellious, but lots of times it's a kind of a passive rebellion, a passive aggressive sometimes rebellion, where they're feeling that, you know, that they really are, they're not naturally conformist compliant folks. They're not the kind of people that when a teacher says, hey, read that book, you know, even though they're finding it completely uninteresting, completely irrelevant, that, you know, years ago that they could blow it off and their life would still be okay. They'd find another vehicle outside of, you know, college and all that kind of stuff. But now, if you don't comply, you're not a more kind of compliant type of person, behaviorally compliant, cognitively compliant, I think you're more of a monkey wrench to a kind of, to the kind of society that we live in, which requires, you know, people more like, for example, a lot of people made the argument when schools became compulsory, you know, there were certainly some progressive people who really wanted everybody to have universal education. But a lot of the reason why that happened, compulsory schooling, was industrial forces that wanted to get people from a very young age in the habit of getting up at a certain time, you know, going someplace they may not want to be, staying there all, you know, day long, not creating a lot of trouble, you know, and having a more, because it fits factory life. And, you know, nowadays, you know, it still fits a kind of more bureaucratized existence that many people live.
If you just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Bruce E. Levine about his book Surviving America's Depression Epidemic. I want to just take a step back here for a moment. I'd like to read a section from page 30. You say that Americans have increasingly lost autonomy and community and have acquired something I call institutionalization, the domination by gigantic, impersonal, bureaucratic, standardized entities. This institutionalization has made many Americans feel small, isolated, helpless, hopeless, scared, angry, bored, alienated, and depressed. Now, what happens then when we lose something about community here as well?
Absolutely, and community is a major part, a major antidote. There's lots of antidotes that you can talk about to depression that mental health professionals are, like I say, they're not talking about at all, or they're, you know, maybe just giving lip service to, but that are hard to sort of like quantify, hard to measure, and that's why one of the reasons why it's not talked about. But actually, community is one of those things that we could actually even see quantifiably. So, for example, let me throw this out there. We know, like I said before, depression rates are going through the roof. We know from lots of studies that people who are isolated, people who are more lonely, are more likely to get depressed. I mean, that's kind of common sense, but you can kind of show that in studies, and it's been done a lot of times. And we also know another thing. We know this through the work of a lot of sociologists, people like Robert Putnam is probably the most well-known at this, showing that there's been a dramatic decimation of community in the last 50 years in the United States. People have fewer friends, they spend less time with them, they spend less time with, you know, coworkers, neighbors, almost any kind of relationship that you would think that would create some kind of social connectedness. There's a decrease of those kinds of things and more isolation. And so it would seem that that's one of the obvious places that we would want to do something about in, as a society. But I also want to say here that the core of depression is pain. And a lot of these, when I'm talking about a lot of these societal, cultural things, it's in the context that we're creating extra amounts of pain. I'm not saying that there aren't also many, many very personal things that are happening to people. So, for example, one of the things that I notice a lot is that divorce is so common that, you know, people, you know, start to think like, well, this is no big deal, its effect on kids. And, you know, and again, I'm not saying that people should stay together for the sake of the children, because it's often much more painful for a kid to be in a miserable, you know, miserable family situation. That's very painful. But it's also painful, too, for kids lots of times to be spending 2 days with one parent, another day with the other one, and going back and forth. And, you know, these kinds of pains are going on all over the place that society is minimizing and not taking seriously. It often happens to me that I'll see a young person who has, you know, as coming from either a miserable miserable family with a miserable marriage, or that it's going through a horrible divorce, or some other major events going on, and the kid will stop, you know, doing well in school because the, you know, kid starts to kind of just want to shut down, not deal with all that pain, move into a kind of depressed state. And what happens is mental health professionals are just more and more just looking at their symptoms, and they're, if they have enough symptoms that click off depression, it's off to the antidepressants, as opposed to taking a look at what's going on a specific individual level, like in that particular family. But also then, we should obviously be doing that as psychologists, social workers, psychiatrists, but then we should also be speaking out about what the heck is happening on a larger scale, on a larger level in our community and society. Some of that, what you just read, some of those institutionalization kinds of things, what price we are paying for our more consumer goods out there.
Yes, and now you just mentioned antidepressants, and you spend a good portion of the book talking about antidepressants and also talking about psychotherapy as it is practiced in the society. Let's start by tackling the issue of antidepressant medication first. You say studies show that they're little better than sugar pills, and that some studies show that they're even worse, that is, that the placebo effect is actually stronger.
Yeah, there's a lot of really interesting studies. This all started to really hit the major media like Newsweek, New York Times. Real scientific community knew this, you know, 15 years ago. But about 2002, you saw reports finally that the New York Times and Newsweek, they were finally catching up. And one of the things that really got a lot of attention was a really interesting study that I talk about in Surviving America's Depression Epidemic. It's a study done out of the University of Connecticut. The researcher, a guy named Kirsch and his team, what they did was they used the Freedom of Information Act. And it's pretty sad commentary on our society that Dr. Kirsch had to use the Freedom of Information Act to get access to all the studies that were submitted to the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA, on antidepressants, on the six major antidepressants over a significant period of time. And so we're talking about Prozac, Paxil, Zoloft, the six major ones. And what Dr. Kirsch found, and you got to understand, these were drug company studies, and which means that they loaded the dice pretty heavily to make these drugs look much better than they really are. But even with drug company funded studies, what Dr. Kirsch found was that in the majority of trials, the drug, the antidepressant, failed to outperform the placebo. You know, which is not to say there's certainly going to be people in your audience who say, wow, my antidepressants saved my life. My antidepressants really helped me. And if you take a look at almost all of these antidepressant studies, roughly somewhere in the range, depending on what criteria they use for success, somewhere between 25 to 35% of people have, say, something positive about their antidepressant treatment. But in real science, you have to compare that to a placebo. And like I say, even in these drug company studies where they use the wrong placebo, and even in those studies, routinely, the placebo does just as well. And so, you know, a lot of what happens, you know, when I talk to people who have benefited from these antidepressants, a lot of what they'll say is that it took the edge off and it helped them. And antidepressant manufacturers don't want you to hear that because that makes these drugs sound too close to illegal psychotropic drugs, whereas reality is chemically they are. So, for example, if you're taking Effexor and you're taking Wellbutrin, you're I don't want to get too technical here, but just for a second, you're affecting serotonin, dopamine, norepinephrine, which is exactly the same chemicals you're affecting when you're taking cocaine. These things are comparable, and so the value of antidepressants, just like any psychotropic drug for people, are one is the placebo effect, and two is that it like any drug from marijuana to alcohol, is going to take the edge off, and there's all kinds of downsides to that. Drug tolerance develops, dependency, and I should also say, if anybody in your audience, and I always want to get this in, the drug companies were dishonest about withdrawal. They always are. Whenever they come up with a new psychiatric drug, they want to, you know, sell it by saying there's no dependency and there's no withdrawal, which is always, almost always untrue because your body adapts. And then, sure enough, now the mainstream press is talking about how there is dramatic withdrawal. But, you know, folks who were real in the real scientific community knew this 10, 15 years ago. You know, one of the things that I really want to make clear when I'm talking about antidepressants, I'm not opposed to people taking them. I've heard stories of people saying that they really had wonderful experiences with them. What I am all about is choice, and I'm all about informed choices, that people should really know what these drugs are, what really causes depression, that there is no, you know, there is no relationship between serotonin deficiency and depression, how these drugs work, what the downside of them, and that's what I'm all about here. It's not, I know there's a lot of people out there who are just anti-drugs, anti-psychiatric drugs, and that's not what I'm about.
But also, you say that there are some other things that are just as effective, such as exercise. I also know that meditation has been used, that is meditation, not medication, has been used pretty successfully with depression. It seems to me that those have a lot fewer downsides.
Absolutely, absolutely. Almost everything out there, if anybody could find anything that really works for them that's not drugs, it's probably going to have a lot fewer downsides. One of the real interesting things that I didn't think I would write about as much as I did, one of the things is I got to writing on this stuff and really took a look at the data, took a look at my clinical experience, took a look at my own personal experience with depression, read memoirs, essays. It really became clear how important belief is, how important what scientists call the placebo effect or expectations, what the rest of the world calls faith and belief. In some ways, all of those words are really kind of synonymous. And when you take a look at even the research on antidepressants, one of the studies I quote there is that when they found a group of people who really, they had strong, high expectations that these drugs were going to work for them, almost 90% had some positive success with it. And then in a group that only felt that it was going to be somewhat positive, just somewhat positive, it went down to about 30%, and they had nobody in this particular study who really didn't have any expectations at all that this drug was going to work. But I work with those people, and the people who really have zero expectations or negative expectations, it doesn't usually work. And that's the same thing that faith or belief or expectation is important for, say, exercise, people who commit themselves to meditation or better nutrition or all of these kinds of things. I mean, there are some obviously clear effects that you can see, endorphin highs from running and all that. But overall, it's really clear to me that coming up with some kind of belief that you really think something is going to work, be an antidote, whatever it is, philosophical, religious, exercise, whatever, that's a real powerful thing. And what happens to a lot of depressed people who I've known, one of the reasons I kind of like them is they're very critical thinking people, and they have a hard time kind of just putting faith and belief in anything, which is a smart idea in a lot of parts of life. But if you have belief or faith in nothing, sometimes it can get in the way of you moving out of your depression. So what I really talk about is really thinking, like, maybe you want to believe in something. You don't have to believe in things that feel ridiculous to you. You certainly don't want to believe that 2 and 2 equal 5, or believe that gravity doesn't exist. But there's a whole other range of human activities that you are allowed to believe in that may actually help you with your despair and depression.
My guest is Bruce E. Levine, and we're talking about his book, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic. Before we move off the mainstream way of looking at depression, this kind of medicalization of it and the use of medication, you say that the technology of assessing depression is faulty. You say there's a kind of technology fundamentalism. You even say it may not be useful to label depression a disease. Talk about that. Say, why is it not a disease? What can we learn from depression, and what can we learn from depressed people?
I think one of the problems with our society is that if you don't label something a disease, and I get this all the time, well, then you're minimizing it. You're saying something's not that big a deal. And I always come back and I say, look, poverty, war, these are horrible things. These are big deals, but they're not diseases. And so the first point I need to make when I'm talking about how it's problematic to medicalize depression is that I'm not trivializing depression. I mean, I've suffered it. People I've worked with, I've spent the life, kind of trying to understand it and help people with it. It is a big deal. But from my experience, the idea of medicalizing depression, of diseasing it for a lot of people is it doesn't really work, because what happens is you start to think that doctors are the only people who can help you with it, that this is a disease that you should, if you're smart, you need to let them deal with. That's not necessarily, the case. And there's a lot of historical figures. I know you've read the book, and I talk about, from Abraham Lincoln to the renowned psychologist William James, who had, well-known bouts of depression. And one of the conclusions that I've come to, and this is, you could actually prove some of this scientifically, but people out there who are real critical thinking tend to feel a lot more pain out there in society. They can sort of see through the untruth. So one of the famous studies that have been done on depressed people is they've taken a look at people, they've given people like kind of rigged games to play where they actually had no control over the outcome. And people who were not depressed really thought they had more control than they really did. And people who were depressed, they knew the reality. They were actually much more in touch with the reality when they were playing the game, that they didn't have any control. There's been some controversy in the whole mental health world recently where a lot of people like the Peter Kramers of the world want to completely disease depression, and they think it's, they claim that it's just total nonsense to romanticize depression by saying that people, writers, artists, and all these kinds of folks are that depression goes hand in hand with it. But I think the science proves them wrong, and I think just basic common sense and my own experience proves me wrong, that if you're more going to be more sensitive to the truths and more sensitive to the pains and more sensitive to the need to have integrity, you may have a significantly more pain in life. And again, the fuel of depression is pain.
And then the remedy, some of the remedies that you go into the book, morale and energy. Talk a little bit about that. I think morale is a very good word for, what you need when you look at the world around you, and you wonder even if, our grandchildren are going to be, are going to have a livable world.
Right. A lot of what I really cared about, and that's a major motivation about writing this book, was writing about morale and energy. Because one of the things that happens to a lot of folks who don't go straight to the antidepressant drug prescribers, say they go to a social worker, psychologist who's not a prescriber, at least in most states they aren't. And, they'll start them off with what we call in the business these cognitive behavioral therapy type things, which in simple terms are things like, trying to get people to have more optimistic thoughts or trying to get them to exercise more, trying to get them to do things which are really good antidotes to depression. But the problem is that when you're, really demoralized and really immobilized, you can't do anything. So sometimes that's one of the ways that, actually people with good intentions, mental health professionals, can make matters worse for depressed people because they ask them, they throw this advice at them. These people are too demoralized to do any of it, and then they feel failure. They feel like they've disappointed their helper. And again, what's failure and disappointment but more pain, and you have more fuel for the depression. So part of what a real skilled helper does with somebody for themselves and for other people is identify somebody who's so depressed, they're so immobilized, that they're so demoralized, that you have to, before you do anything, you have to break up that vicious cycle of demoralization. And just real quickly, to kind of go through, and I go through it a lot more length in the book, but what happens to depressed people is that they're depressing. What depression is it's not some chemical brain imbalance. It's a shutdown. People, human beings, have a wide variety of strategies that they use to shut down overwhelming pain. Some of us just start drinking alcohol. Some of us get out the marijuana. Some of us try to divert it through watching television all day long. Some of us compulsively eat. There's a wide variety. And one of the things that we do is to kind of shut ourselves down psychologically by using this thing called depression. And if you take a look at the symptoms of depression, you'll see they're all shut down. It's a loss of interest. It's this loss of energy. And so what happens, though, you can't selectively shut down your pain. You ultimately shut down your whole being. And so you move to a state of kind of immobilization. Well, that state, that what happens to people when they're really depressed is they really get self-absorbed in their own pain, and they get in the way of themselves. It may make matters even worse. And I'm not putting down, I know when I'm depressed, I'm self-absorbed. And you move into this kind of vicious cycle of doing anything not to feel pain. And what you have to do for yourself, or you can do for somebody else, and I do this all the time with clientele, is doing anything, even if it's a silly, goofy distraction, but something to pull them out of that vicious cycle. And so I have a bunch of subchapters in that chapter of talking about some of the different things that I've learned.
And a remedy you talk about, or approach that people can take, both with themselves or their treaters can take, and that is a rather cryptic term called Zyroting.
You like that, eh? Well, the story behind Zyroting was that one of the most obvious important things for morale that people have known for antiquity is some kind of people, you know, validating, you know, your pain, empathizing with your pain, giving you some respect. And one of the points I make in that subchapter is that corporate culture has gotten a hold of this thing called stroking, and now they're using it to kind of manipulatively motivate people rather than paying them a higher salary. And so, you know, nowadays, more and more, we recoil as a culture from when you hear somebody saying, well, I understand, or I feel your pain. And so one of the points that I made in the book was that, you know, a few friends of mine were sitting around one day, and we said, wow, we're going to have to come up with a whole new word, because that whole idea of morale boosting and validating and empathizing, which is a powerful thing, has kind of been stolen by the corporate manipulators. So let's come up with a new word for the healthier thing. And so we came up with Zyroting, because I actually have learned a couple of things from these pharmaceutical company manufacturers. What they do, people will notice this as soon as I say that. Well, why is it that there's a Z or an X in all of these antidepressants, Paxil, Zyrode, Effexor, on and on, Zoloft? And it's because the corporate manipulators realize that there's not a lot of words in the English language with Z or X in it. So if they put those letters in it, there's more likely that people will remember it.
That's great. So Zyroting, respecting, validating, empathizing, and supporting. All about real healing. So what is real healing?
I think that's a great question. Of all the things that when I'm doing, you know, interviews, it's probably the hardest thing to kind of talk about in a couple of minutes. But generally, healing is about becoming more whole. And generally, what happens to a lot of people out there is that they have a kind of deep wounds, deep pains, ego attachments, resentments. They've lost wholeness internally. They're hating an aspect of who they are, or there's a break between them and other people, or, you know, it's just a break from them and nature. You know, that's really important. So wholeness is really important between you and nature, between you and people, and also internally between what you really believe and the basic components of your humanity. And so what healing is often about, and anybody I think out there in your audience who's experienced healing, a lot of it has to do with really them feeling cared about, feeling nurtured, feeling loved. And also, healing happens when you care about some other aspect of life. So there's a lot of people out there in our society, another depressing thing, but I think, you know, true, is that a lot of people out there who have been subject to so much neglect, so much abuse, so much violence, that it's very hard for them to trust other human beings. And so if you were to tell them, well, open yourself up to being cared about somebody else, they'll say, you got to be kidding. I mean, every time that's happened, I've gotten crushed. You know, and then, well, you say, well, maybe it would help if you moved into healing of some other person. And they'll go very angrily, why should I care about somebody else? Nobody's ever cared about me. You know, and that's sad, because, you know, part of what we know, you know, is very healing to care about somebody else out there. So sometimes, for some people, the only thing that, when they're that, you know, whatever you want to call it, damaged, you know, by life, by people life out there, is that they will achieve the beginnings of healing by caring about animals or caring about plants, you know, caring about gardening. And there's a lot of famous historical examples of people who've begun their route back to healing by caring about just non-human parts of life. And so a lot of, you know, a lot of healing has to do with being cared about and caring yourself.
The book is Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy, and we've been talking with its author, Dr. Bruce Levine. Well, that's it this week for Writer's Voice. Please join us next week when we come to you with a report and interviews from the Nieman Conference on Narrative Journalism. To learn more about Writer's Voice, visit our website. There you can download or stream podcasts of our program, look at our archives, find out who's coming up on the show, and tell us what you think. Thanks for listening to Writer's Voice. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.